Hey, everyone. I want to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Copper. Copper is an institutional custodian in crypto and provider of prime services. They're also one of my favorite companies in the space. So thank you very much to Copper for making this episode possible. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the show. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety-first L2, accelerating the transition to an on-chain financial system. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the episode. But for now, on with the program. All right, everyone, welcome back to another roundup of On the Margin. Today, I'm joined as always by my trusty Hocoast. Jesus.
Hocoast.
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 We had to cut that. Quinn Thompson, Tyler Neville, fellas, how we doing?
Good, man.
Good, good.
Am I going to get away? Are you looking guys going to get away with that little snafu there? Or...
I was going to make a comment.
Looking forward to DAS.
Yeah. Hey, Tyler, we got Quinn coming out to DAS.
Oh.
Where are you, man?
You know, Tyler,
you 24 hours.
He convinced me to come. I'm booking the flights, and then he put me in the last panel of the whole event to moderate. Sorry. It's at 4 p.m. on Wednesday. I didn't even know the conference went that long.
We saved the best for last, buddy.
There's going to be four people in this thing. He's like, yeah, you can come here.
Dude, actually, this is the most well-attended DAS by like country miles, not even close. We usually bake in like a bunch of extra room based on what we think we're going to do in terms of attendance, but eventually the fire marshal shuts you down and we've like exceeded the fire marshal amount. And then we built in some amount that we think won't show and we're still like bumping up against it. So honestly, I think it's more of a market thing and more of a London thing. Like US is pretty, there's like a real amount of activity in this industry that moved out of the US. Like Europe, we've hosted events at London before. It was always kind of dead. But it is back in a huge way. I honestly think the SEC pushed some amount of activity out of the U.S. Like,
they've got to kill Andreessen.
Do you hear them? They're talking about London. Like, that was part of our data point. Like, they're all in on London, the U.K., Europe. Like, they're opening up offices there.
Wow.
It's kind of tough over here. Yeah. Still.
Pretty good.
Why don't we start? We've been talking a lot about altcoins. People are not happy in the comments of this show. Why don't we talk a little bit about the macro? It's been a hot week for, we had a pretty smoking hot PPI report that came out this week. And we had a slightly, let's say maybe warmer CPI report come out. And I would just be curious to get your guys' opinions on this, Quinn. I saw you tweeting. The details here are on a month over month basis for February. The actual for PPI was, it came in at 0.6 versus 0.3 in expectations. And year over year, the expectation was a 0.9% growth and we had 1.6. So those are pretty hot. And I think, you know, PPI tends to lead CPI. It's pretty correlated. It's not always one to one, but I think that would be the concern is that basically inflation is picking back up from here. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think, the trend for me seems pretty clear since middle to late last year that we bottomed, and it doesn't mean we are going back to 8 or so, but we're not going to 2, you know? So this one, the market shook everything off until this one, and we'll see if it's longer than a few days lived. But I think that at some point it's got to take notice, but I don't think it causes too much havoc to risk. Just, I think there's probably a blip or two, similar to some bouts we've had, when yields started rising on the long end in the last 2 years. It's good for risk when inflation expectations are rising and long end yields stay grounded, as that pushes real rates lower, positive for Bitcoin, positive for stocks. But then there's these little spurts where the nominal long end, catches up, yields are rising, and that sends real rates up. So I think could be, bumps over the next 2 to 4 weeks as the market kind of digests, like, okay, inflation is not still declining. We're not in disinflation anymore. And let's see what the Fed does next week and if they change the dot plots or anything. But I'm watching. I'm not putting the foot on the gas on risk here, but I do think it's more of a blip than a longer term problem.
What do you think, Kevin?
Yeah. I got to read this. This is from David Zervos. He wrote this in terms of the inflation. He said, I don't want to overreact to a small sample of data, but there are clearly benefits to transitory periods of higher inflation that many folks may be missing. Sticky inflation that coincides with no meaningful change in long-run inflation expectations creates a huge benefit for leveraged balance sheets. Anchored inflation expectations keep the pace on long-run growth expectations, while short-run inflation spike devalues debt and revalues assets. Inflation is a natural deleverager, which in a highly indebted society like the U.S. creates huge benefits. So like to what Quinn was saying, the 2 to 10 year curve is actually like not really reacting. It's still in this downtrend. And until you see that really sharply rise, I don't think you're going to have massive credit issues. And then go to like high yield CDS. And, you know, maybe we can put up a long-term chart of this, but it's at 332, which is like almost at, you know, 2 year lows. It's pretty much at 2 year lows and almost getting into the 2021 range. So are there credit issues? Maybe for certain select companies, but largely still no problems there. And CPI, it comes out a little bit hot, might not even be a bad thing. It lets you naturally delever your balance sheet.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that like the market's going to, like oil's staying relatively fine. Like it's moving higher. I think copper, you know, commodities have had a strong week, but they're not like going crazy. So it's, you have this weird, it could be stagflation. We don't know. You know, we got to see what's happened on the growth side. But
stagflation, is that Wisconsin?
Yeah. You know, got the bag. Yeah. Oh, here we go. Yeah. No, but yeah, I think, I mean, it's a very positive environment for Bitcoin and gold, particularly in these cases where, and stocks should do well as well. But we've seen this gold move as in. And Bitcoin, of course, has been very positive.
Do you guys think there's some element, because the market did sell off a little bit, crypto sold off a good amount, Bitcoin is down about 10%, something like that. Do you think there's some amount, though, of just both the stock market, if you look at the chart of the S&P and just total crypto market cap, it was on a tear there. And I do wonder if this is like maybe a little bit of an excuse to sell off. Some of the leverage ended up getting shaken out. I mean, that could be it as well, I think.
Yeah, I think the risk parity funds and like, you know, all these CTAs were overexposed. And so when you get a volatility spike on an event, it causes like natural delevering there. And I think what else is happening below the surface, if you look like large cap tech, I mean, I don't want to call the top in large cap tech, but it's, they're definitely, you know, if you look at these charts, the concentration is so high. And you can see IWMs kind of like outperform. So you're seeing that rotation of capital out of large cap tech and into other parts of the market. And, you know, the Russell specifically. And, you know, I'm thinking this could possibly be, you know, a 2001 type scenario where you see passive funds are all in large cap tech. And if you have outflows there, you could see outperformance from like active management and value investors in IWM for the next 10 years. Like this could be partly why Larry Fink needed the Bitcoin frontier exposure, is if you get that natural outflow. And that doesn't mean, you know, the Qs can't keep going up, but you might just get a rotation and underperformance on the passive side.
Yeah, I think that's right. I like to watch like XLE over QQQ or XLE over SPY, like something more commodities, and that's been a pretty good barometer for this sort of thing. I think as rates are structurally higher for longer, like it seems like we've been talking about the same phrase, you know, higher for longer for like 8 years. And I think those plays probably do outperform, and you get that broadening out of the dispersion.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a quick shout out to this episode's sponsor, Copper. Copper is an institutional custodian and provider of prime services within digital assets. Today, what I want to talk to you specifically about is Clearloop. Clearloop is a solution from Copper, which to me solves one of the biggest problems for market makers, high frequency traders, hedge funds within digital assets. You know the exquisite pain of what I call the pre-funding problem. So if you want to take advantage of arbitrages that pop up across different exchanges, or you just have a trading strategy which requires you to be active on multiple different centralized exchanges, you have to pre-fund your account at each one of those exchanges. Now, this is not ideal for a whole bunch of reasons. One, you have to take counterparty risk from those exchanges, which, as we saw this last year, can have major consequences. Two, it's capital inefficient. You have a whole bunch of assets spread out that are, most of them are not doing anything most of the time. And three, it's just not great from a workflow standpoint, and it creates administrative overhead. So enter Clearloop. Clearloop is the secure MPC custody solution provided by Copper. The way that it works is you deposit your assets into this MPC solution, which is owned and operated by you. Clearloop syncs up with a whole bunch of your favorite exchanges, and then you can trade securely from Clearloop itself while not taking any counterparty exchange risk with any of these exchanges. And it's a super easy and nice UX. Now, Clearloop is trusted by the likes of Flow Traders, Brevan Howard, Nickel, some of the best in the business. But the coup de grace is, in the extreme edge case that one of these exchanges were to go bankrupt, they have a very clever trust structure which segregates your assets and keeps you completely protected. So click the link at the bottom of this episode, especially if you're a hedge fund and market maker and you want to learn more. Or better yet, Dimitri, the CEO, is actually going to be in person on a panel hosted by yours truly at Digital Asset Summit. So DAS London, that's March 18th to the 20th in London. So you should definitely click the link at the bottom of this episode, give your boy some credit, but also, even better, come to DAS London and hear from Dimitri himself. All right, cheers everyone.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety first layer two that is accelerating the transition to the on-chain financial system. Now, I know we're all very excited about tokenization. Larry Fink certainly is. He's on CNBC talking about it all the time. And I know we're all very excited about L2s. Here's the problem though. If we want L2s to onboard the financial system, there's a lot of stuff that we still need, and Kinto is basically rolling out solutions for that. So one, it features user-owned KYC, which is just table stakes for our regulated friends. And if we want the institutional capital to come in, Kinto offers a really good solution for that. They also have native account abstraction that solves some of the largest problems with onboarding in terms of security and user experience today, which is still very confusing. So if we want to bring more folks onto Ethereum, Kinto is the way to do that. And if you believe in this on-chain financial system and you actually want to get more active in Kinto and become a founding member, you should join their launch program, which is Engine. That's E-N-G-N. You can see a link in the show notes. So if you're a part of that, you can do things like participate in Kinto governance, the launch ceremony, you can priority access to product launches on Kinto. You get reduced fees and unique discounts on products launch on Kinto. So overall, if you want to be a part of Kinto and the mission that they have, I would go click the link, join the Engine program, and thank me later.
I guess one thing that would be interesting to watch is just what longer dated treasuries are doing. So the 10-year, the 30-year. And they haven't really, I mean, it jumped a little bit on this news, but it hasn't really moved that much. It does look like, I mean, everything kind of peaked back in October of last year, and it's just been sort of ranging here. Actually, I could pull up a chart. It does sort of look like, I mean, not to be, you know, armchair TA guy here, but it does sort of look like it might have peaked in October, and it's sort of making in this like higher lows type behavior. So I guess this would be the thing that I would be watching, just in terms of like if there's any real movement in terms of longer dated yields. But until that happens, it feels like this is probably just a minor blip. What would make you guys really concerned about inflation actually meaningfully ticking back off from here? Or do you think it's just not a massive deal? And
I think the things I'm watching is like, obviously the rates and commodities, I think, will be the first to move. Like the Fed's going to be reactive, right? And even if we're seeing inflation's sticky, it's not going to two. And they're, I wouldn't say they've changed their tune. It's not like they've always said they need to be back to two before they cut, but they definitely are biased towards cuts, and they're looking for reasons to cut. They're not looking for reasons to not cut or stay higher. So you have to play with that in mind, and over the long term, that's structurally bullish, you know, inflation assets, you know, commodities being one of them. And you would expect the long end to tighten financial conditions if things, you know, people start to lose faith that they've conducted the soft landing with, you know, inflation under control. But yeah, it doesn't appear that anything's ripping out too crazily, and that 210 spread would be another good one to watch.
What's sneaky is like the XLE is almost at new highs here. So if that breaks out, maybe we get a flurry of inflation worries. And, you know, let's see, oil's at $81 a barrel. It's getting close to highs. So I don't know. We could have a little inflation shock here. It's probably better to be a little conservative in the near term.
Yeah.
I think that's partly why you're seeing that rotation out of big tech. You know, there's this thing where, you know, being long energy is really being short tech. And we're probably seeing that play out to a certain extent. Now, that doesn't mean Bitcoin can't work in that environment. In fact, there might be this psychological shift towards Bitcoin, especially into the halving, where it can be that store of value in inflationary environment. So just to caveat that.
How do you guys explain? It's been sort of interesting to watch Tesla stock, which has been so bulletproof for so long. I mean, really take a pretty sustained beating here. And I don't know. My thought on this has sort of been, this is Tesla was like the hot money rotation thing for so long. I mean, it's the equivalent of Dogecoin, sort of just keeps going up even when you don't think it really should. And now that's sort of Nvidia. And so maybe some of that Tesla money is just rotating into Nvidia and AI and all that stuff. But how do you explain? I mean, it's been interesting to watch the stock. It's down something like 60% from the highs.
I think Tesla is just a China story. And they had a lot of EV demand. I think the whole ESG narrative is kind of fading here. So you're getting some outflows in those funds. And passive, it is the passive stock. Like, Musk couldn't have done what he did without a massive help from passive management choking his float. And I think that's just, this is part of the nature of markets slowly correcting themselves.
Yeah, I'm not too close on Tesla in particular, but I think, yeah, the EV trend there's been a reversal. It's probably been the strongest of all those types of businesses.
Yeah.
But obviously weaker than the other Mag 7s.
Apple is in a similar boat to Tesla here. So maybe China, or Tyler, that would support your China hypothesis.
Yeah. And look at like things like Nike, like all these big multi, you know, conglomerate corporations, globalist corporate corporations, there's risk there now. There's geopolitical risk is a real thing now. And I think people are starting to realize that. And that's the overarching macro here is you can't just buy this giant corporation and expect them to grow ad infinitum. And especially in a world that's kind of deglobalizing in a sense. Or realigning, you know, trade partners.
I wanted to get your guys' take on Michael Saylor doing his thing again. And this is sort of this sort of rhymes with this like longstanding bet the two of you guys have, which we'll be watching closely between Coin and Bitcoin. But one thing that sort of surprised me is the MicroStrategy outperformance here relative to Bitcoin. Like, we were talking about this a little bit on our chat this week, but I don't know this. So there's, for folks who haven't heard us talk about this before, I've always thought there's this sort of premium on public market proxies for Bitcoin, which is why it tends to overperform during bull markets and then underperform during bears, because there is, you know, people didn't want to touch the spot, but there's still an enormous amount of demand for exposure to Bitcoin. So people would bid up these like crypto stocks or like Coinbase, MicroStrategy, it was Silvergate last cycle, at least and Voyager, Galaxy, these things did really, really well. But you know, with the advent of the Bitcoin ETFs, it doesn't really make sense to me that that premium should still exist. But just look at the outperformance of MicroStrategy relative to Bitcoin here. You could take, this is on a 6-month time horizon, but I think if you took it back even like a year, it would look very similar. Do you guys have a good explanation for why MicroStrategy is still doing so well here? I mean, why are people buying MicroStrategies instead of just the ETFs?
I think, I mean, when they get into these stratosphere moves, like it's tough to put a finger on exactly why, right? Like there's some meme ability in it, like the GameStop situation. There's obviously the hype around Bitcoin and excitement there. And, you know, I mean, the volatility, he's able to rip these converts off and it creates more, you know, eyeballs and things. So I don't have a great explanation. I definitely wouldn't try and step in front of it. Like, you got to really watch for a breakdown, and it's tough to get bearish on Bitcoin here. If there is a little weakness in broader equities, though, that could be a catalyst for this to slow down. I mean, pushing two converts over $1 billion in the market of your stock, obviously it's not that full amount, but that helps put some sell pressure.
Yeah, there's also, I mean, I'm not speaking specifically to this, but there's probably a pair's trade going on long the coin, short the other one. And I think that's blowing a lot of people up because they're frustrated.
there's a premium there, but then there's, this goes back to the whole float dynamics of when your float's held by passive, it really makes it hard to short these things. And that was GameStop scenario. And so there is a liquidity component here that most fundamental analysts don't take into consideration. And then, you know, from a, if I was theoretically long 10 billion in Bitcoin and the liquidity is getting really good on the coin and you can probably lend it out, and then there's a whole new business line that creates a whole bunch of cash flows. I don't know if that was the company. I mean, maybe that's worth a lot more than just the coin, right? So that's, you know, an interesting dynamic that I don't hear that many people bring up right now. So,
yeah, I think the framework guys mentioned that there, the demand to lend out, you know, people are approaching them, asking them to lend out their Bitcoin is like very, very high. I mean, unsurprisingly in recent days. So that, I think, Tyler, that supports what you were describing there. I mean, what's up, Quinn?
I was going to say, there's also the rumors about it being, you know, in the S&P, which the S&P turned it down last cycle. So I don't know, not sure why they changed their mind, given it's just kind of like a glorified ETF. But I mean, imagine shorting that and I think it gets put in the S&P. I mean, that would be a tough spot to be in.
It just feels silly to short MicroStrategy here relative to, I don't know. I mean, even if you were to just take like a super left curve take and say, maybe it's some kind of additional beta or risk premium on top of Bitcoin. Like it feels pretty risky to be shorting Bitcoin here, just based on what Bitcoin and crypto tends to do when it breaks through previous all-time highs. I just don't think the risk reward really feels like it's there. And yeah, Saylor's like doing his thing. I mean, I'm less familiar with the exact terms of these converts and stuff like that. But yeah, I think it ended up being, there was initially a $500 million offering that they upped to 700. And then they did an additional $500 million on top of that. So it's like $1.2 billion total in converts. Pretty cheap financing as well. I mean, is he just going to run this playbook back? I think he's got over 1% of the Bitcoin supply now as well.
Generational arbitrage. I mean, that's what it, until there's like a, when you're offering debt that's so cheap and that just will stay. If Janet Yellen wants the long end of the curve to stay low, somehow you can just issue debt. I don't know how there's not more people doing this. Like, that's my big question is like Bukele, you know, Saylor, why aren't more people doing this just on a pure competition standpoint?
I mean, I would get worried if everyone started doing that. Like, I mean, think about what you have to believe to run that trade, right?
So here's the thing though. Like, go back to the tulip bubble. One of the big ways to value an asset, any asset, is use as collateral. And what this is really rewriting like corporate finance books, where, you know, what the one thing that created a bubble of tulips was like, you could borrow your tulips. You could borrow money against your tulips, right?
Yeah.
And so that is sort of the first stage of kind of like creating this lending market for an asset. And the more people do it, you know, like if El Salvador does it and another country does it, and we're finding that it's working. Right. They didn't get any margin calls in the last cycle. You know, obviously there's risk there, but the fact that everyone is calling it, you know, there's a lot of risk there. Look at the best performing bond was MicroStrategy. It was a converts. So if you're a bond manager, I mean, he says this in an interview, but if you're a bond manager and you want yields and you're like, oh my God, I can get this like super, you know, duper performance and that like that's adds beta to my portfolio that I would never have. You're gonna sop that up. It's why these things are oversubscribed. So why don't you do that? Why aren't other companies doing this just as like maybe do it on a small scale? I don't know.
I agree. I think it's at a fundamental level. He's built an incredible brand and reputation and advocacy. Like, so there's more to it than just the Bitcoin. But fundamentally, all he did was raise money to buy Bitcoin. So like, if I'm like the CEO of some sleepy, you know, middle market public company, like, give it a go. Like, I don't know what, like, he talks. I love his interview. I love his interviews because he goes on CNBC and things and gives his playbook like as clear and transparent as possible. He's like, yes, I bought Bitcoin with the company that then increased our implied volatility in that trades much higher than Bitcoin itself. People like to speculate that then allows me to issue these converts at a huge premium, raise more capital, buy more Bitcoin that adds, like, that's all it is. And every time he does this, I mean, to the point about shorting, like, it's, I don't think it's always going to trade at this like 70 to 100% premium to its underlying like book value. It gets pretty crazy. So I'm also not a buyer here. But you know, he hasn't like, they haven't done anything that crazy. So I am surprised that other people haven't just tried this as well. And I think you will see it.
I think it speaks to, if I had to guess at that, like, and put myself in the shoes that most people are operating in, I think it speaks to this belief that I have that I voiced to you guys a couple episodes ago, which is, I don't think there's still a lot of conviction. I don't think the majority of people look at Bitcoin as this like store of value, like long-term, this is going to be some very successful sort of check against. I think if everyone believed that, then more people would be running this trade. I really think the perspective is that most people in TradFi view Bitcoin in the way that crypto natives look at meme coins. They're like, it's fun. It's going to go up. Okay. It's probably like here to stick around. Like I'll dabble, I'll like chuck a couple bucks in. I really think that's how people look at it. And the reason why you aren't seeing this trade get run more often is because if you were to look at Bitcoin through that lens and then you take out debt to buy Bitcoin and that Bitcoin goes down, then you're screwed, right? If it goes up, then you look like a genius. If it goes down, you're screwed.
Okay. Let me take the flip side of this. Because for people were doing this with commercial real estate for years and years and years. And it was this, that was the asset. Now, here's something that Louis Gov brought up that's really fascinating. When the US basically said to Russia, hey, we're going to take away your assets here. They're not yours anymore. What do you say to every global geopolitical partner that invested in real estate? You're saying, okay, now there's actually a risk here, right? There used to be not a risk. Tomorrow I could be Saudi Arabia and all of a sudden like my money's not good in the US. Now that's fascinating from a lot of different perspectives, but mainly if you're looking for a decentralized store of value, that's kind of interesting, right? And so they were borrowing for years and years and years in buying these commercial real estate buildings. This is just the flip side of that trade. And I keep saying it, but like, it's not, you're watching commercial real estate implode. And like, where do you put those dollars? Where do you put the recycling of all those dollars?
I mean, Tyler, you're preaching to the converted here. I'm with you. But I also just don't think that's how most people view it. The Russia confiscation of their central bank assets was such an interesting moment in time because I agree with you. I looked at that as, that was one of this like longer journey of mine of like the Canadian truckers was a data point. Like this was a big data point that I just think the government is getting it its own way here with, I think that's ultimate, but a lot of people that didn't register the same way. They were like, yeah, that is the right thing to do. And they didn't see the same risk there. It would actually, the Saudi Arabia point's really interesting. Can you, just as a hypothetical thought experiment for you guys, if MBS pulled the same shit with Khashoggi that he did a couple of years ago, do you think now there would be calls for like much more serious calls for boycotting Saudi Arabia or confiscating something? You know what I mean? Like,
great question.
And that wasn't that long ago, right? But like, how would we receive that now?
I think they're too differentiated into the financial system. They back every VC and there's hidden forces there. That's why it went.
Dimitri.
Hidden forces. It would be a lot of talk. It'd be a lot of talk, you know, a lot of like, you know, all talk basically fluff, just like, cause until it raised oil, you know, and then sent inflation higher and caused problems to assets and then, you know, lost our venture funding and, it's just all, you know, the money speaks and at the end of the day. And on the MSTR convert point, like taking the other side, yes, you can get this upside and if you're a bond investor, but they also were probably puking their guts when the converts from last cycle were busted. You know, the bonds trading at 60 cents and you know, so I think it cuts both ways, but it's a fantastic financial engineering, and he's a genius. Saylor's a genius.
I think that's you kind of have to say that, right? Like, he didn't get the margin call in. He didn't go bust. You got to give him some credit, just like Bukele. And
yeah,
I love Bukele being like, someone, they still haven't, you know, written a pro article about me yet, which makes me think we're earlier than later. Like, once they start, you know, pumping these guys' tires, and it's very similar to the Tesla thing, because everyone was hating on Musk being like, this company is fake, you know, his financials are fake, you know, all these things on the way up. He just had that pessimism while it grew. And now the pessimism's not there and the stock's imploding. I think they're riding that same wave here. So we will see.
You need a wall of worry to climb.
Yeah.
Do you? Here's something that people in crypto, Bitcoin land have been talking about quite a bit, is that, and myself included, this breaking of the all-time high, the beginning of this cycle feels a little bit different, at least to me, than it did in the past. A little bit less euphoric. There's a lot of worry about, I see this all over my timeline now, people worrying about a triple top. You know, the funniest thing to happen is the thing that's going to happen. And it would be kind of hilarious if we like bounced around the 69K level for the third time and then fell from here. This is going to sound like one of the things that I also look at that isn't, I guess, like public knowledge is Blockworks backend. And like our audience metrics went nuts in 2021. I mean, everything was like not only up and to the right, but it was like parabolic, like the amount of followers and listeners and everything we're gaining. And it's definitely strong now, but it's nothing like what it felt like back then. And there's a guy named Ben Cowan. I'll find these charts. He tweeted these great charts where he somehow is able to aggregate listeners and new subscribers from popular YouTube channels. And it shows basically exactly what it feels like instinctively to me, which is, here, I'll show you guys this. So this, I don't know if you can see this, or I'll zoom in a little bit. This top chart here, or this bottom chart, is YouTube views. So this is basically, you can see it's like around half, you know, halfway where it was back in 2021. But the amount of new subscribers coming to these channels is like nothing, right? It's basically, you know, there's like a little blip here, but it's just absolutely nothing compared to what it was. And this jibes with a couple other interesting data points, which is, you know, conferences, like, you know, the conference in 2018, 2019, the consensus went from 15,000 people to like 1,200 people. Like, it imploded, you know, and it felt like a ghost town. And then it really got built back up. I don't think as many people left the ecosystem this time. There were multiple conferences that happened during the heart of the bear market, like 25,000 people. That is unheard of. That was a massive deviation from my standpoint. And so it sort of feels like less people left last cycle, but not that many new people have come back yet either.
See, this is the proprietary data that I came for. I mean, this is crazy.
Here's that alpha, baby.
Here's my indicator is when someone stops you in the street and is like, hey, Mike Ippolito from Blockworks? Oh my God. That's the top. That's the top right there.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's ever happening, but yeah.
On the margin, right?
On the margin?
Yeah. When we were out in Brooklyn the other evening, when Mike and I were together, it was nonstop.
Yeah.
Couldn't get
people beating our door down.
I think, hey, I mean, they would just sell
everything. Just sell everything.
Like, when you look at those charts, the first thing I thought of was like super cycle. Like, I mean, it's not even close. But you also have to remember, I think everyone's just like so like focused on these like 4-year bull bear, crazy parabola up, crazy parabola down. And when we talk about like this overall structurally long term vol dampening thing, it's like, no, it's a normal asset class now, right? There's an ETF. Like, people don't just like puke their bags like 15% and nuke everybody and wick it back up. Like, it's an institutional asset class now. And that's how things trade when it's not just a bunch of monkeys. And like, I think you have a situation where the cycle can go much longer. And like, I tweeted in September, October, I was like, the best thing you can do is get out of a 4-year bull bear cycle. Because you could look at that chart that you just showed, Mike, and say, well, that's why alts haven't ran, because we're actually not even to the point where alts would run if you know, YouTube, which would be one of the best retail indicators of activity, is not even close. And then you obviously have the meme coin stuff. So I think it paints a bullish picture. You just buy dips to the moving average. And also remember, 2021 was this animal where like every single person in the whole entire world was a day trading, like stock gambler, crypto gambler. Like I can't, like every single friend of mine following COVID was like punting calls on Tesla and SPACs. And like, so that indiscriminate pick any asset that exists, go up, was a, you know, severe function of Fed and, you know, a bunch of stimmy checks, which it's a different environment. So I don't think we have that crazy euphoria type of, you know, setup here, but you know, we can stay in this constructive price environment for a long time. The flows are legit.
I agree. If you look at Robinhood just had earnings the other last week, and they were saying the retail investors starting to come back, right? Their growth there is actually pretty good. And I think that is an indicator. Last time Robinhood was going, you know, haywire with crypto, and it's basically made a 2-year base in coming out of that. If you look at the weekly chart, it's looks pretty good and no one's talking about it.
I have seen a couple of people talk about Robinhood and you know what? I was just looking at this chart and thinking, I actually flashed back to this guy, Ben Cowan, came on the margin. Yeah. Right around this time. And it was around the time where like, you can see the second blip in this. And I remember him mentioning, he was like, you know, cause this was a weird period of time to live through. This like late 21, early 22 period felt weird also. And I remember him saying at the time, he was like, by the way, like I think retail's left the market. Like I can see it in my YouTube numbers. And I just remember thinking like, there's probably some real alpha in these YouTube numbers.
Yeah.
And you know where it actually is too? It's really 4chan. I think most narratives in crypto are born on 4chan before they even make it into. It's almost like 4chan is like the dirty, you know, petri dish of where like raw narratives get formed in the retail, and then like some of that like crosses the chasm to YouTube. I think that's where it all starts, to be honest with you.
Yeah, we should go to the next point, which is Matt Hogan, who's spitting straight fire these days.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'll pull this up. I think, yeah, why don't you introduce it? Because it goes hand in hand with that like institutional and leverage stuff.
Well, here, I'm going to look for the tweet so I can actually share my screen. But here's Matt Hogan's great. Yeah, I'll just read what he said here. For everyone wondering who is buying Bitcoin ETFs, I'd circle May 15th on your calendar. Investors with more than 100 million in AUM have to file reports with SEC called 13F filings. These are due 45 days out. Well, they don't capture everyone. They're just a snapshot in time. I think some of the names on those filings will surprise to the upside. So he's also been sort of live tweeting almost like his experience in talking to. He's kind of doing the rounds. He's on the road right now. He's talking to a whole bunch of institutional investors, RIAs. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if that was the tweet you were thinking of, Tyler, if there was something else, but
it was.
I think what he's implying there is that it's not just going to be retail mom and pop and grandmas. And they're actual some real people with some real money that are buying these things.
Yeah. And to boot, I think, you know, there's pension funds definitely along this stuff now. There's endowments along this stuff. Now you're getting to the point where if you don't own a little bit of it, you're actually at risk. We're hitting that point of the psychology, I think, which makes it massively de-risked. In fact, like if you're the first one borrowing money to buy this stuff, I'd be worried if everyone was doing it. It's just, I think in the cycle, once you see May 15th and you're like, oh my God, you know, CalPERS bought 1% of Bitcoin or whatever it is. You see these numbers, it's going to be a psychological shift. So I think, you know, you have happening in April and then this date in May might really be another catalyst, you know, to spark things.
I think you're right. And that's the type of thing that generates news headlines as well. X, and I remember these from late 2020, early 20. It was Ruffer, it was One River, those sorts of firms that were buying back then, big, you know, $600 million slugs. That moved the market for sure. Not only in terms of the actual flows, but just getting people excited. And it was like a whole new bunch of legitimacy.
Who for you guys would you get most, or would you, maybe if not you personally, that could be the same, could not be, or would the markets get most excited about seeing that come up on their statement? Like, I was trying to think about this, and it's like, okay, if Druck and PJ Teapot, and it's like, we all love those guys, you know, they're unreal, but it's like, yeah, they would buy it, you know? So it's like less of a big time eye opener for the market, right? They've talked about it. They own it already. Who would be like a surprise that it's like, oh shit, like these guys are bought in? Like, it's a really good question.
I think it's going to be a country. Like, we call it the concentric circles of adoption, right? You had the PTJ moment in the last cycle where it was like, okay, he de-risked it. If he owns it, I can own it as a hedge fund manager. Now hedge fund managers all own it. Like, to Bianco's point, that's probably who's bought a lot of it. But maybe there's this another concentric circle of adoption of Qatar, or I don't know, any other Argentina country like that.
Okay, let's assume here, because obviously it depends, right? If I was even thinking about Qatar, and it's like, that going to really move the market? Maybe it obviously depends on partially the size, like how much they would buy, right? So like, let's just say there's some amount that's like significant, but not massively significant, like $500 million or something like that, or even $1 billion at this point is probably in that ballpark. I think the what would make the biggest headlines for me would be either like a really legit, very long-term oriented, like sovereign wealth fund, like one of the Singaporean sovereign wealth funds or something like that. Or could be.
Well, isn't like, Mubadala or Mubadabadala, that they're invested in Web3. Like, I think like I've butchered that. It's really, every time I say it, it's just impossible. I think they are investors in a bunch of VC crypto funds.
Yeah. I mean, you have the Singapore sovereign wealth, you have El Salvador, you know, you had the state of Arizona or whatever. I mean, again, like who, you only report your asset holdings if you have to. Why would a sovereign, like, if I'm Saudis or somebody trying to bid up 10 billion of Bitcoin, I'm not going to go tell the world so to let them front run me in 2x the price before I can get my orders in. Like, absolutely not. Same if you're Apple or Facebook. Like, none of these companies are going to tell anybody. Like, they all own it probably, you know, for all we know. And it's just like this gap risk that sits there in the market when sentiment's really strong. We're in a bull market. People are excited about the asset. Like, it's like there's that upside risk. You like, you know.
So what about like Musk? You know, last cycle was Musk, right? He bought it and Tesla, and that was like boom, and then overnight it jacked up. If Bezos says he bought it, one of those billionaires that have like massive, I know, I think Zuckerberg,
can you imagine that they already own it? These guys already have to have exposure to this, right? I've just been operating on that assumption. There's no way that Jeff Bezos has zero exposure to crypto.
It's probably why he's selling his stock.
Maybe.
But it's more about at the company level, I think, if they really got the conviction. They definitely own it personally, no question. But if they got the conviction to put it on the corporate balance sheet.
What do you guys think about this? So I have been a hater of this Bitcoin on corporate balance sheet trend for a while. I just don't think that this makes sense from... That's just not how, like, if you've interacted with many like CFOs or like corporate treasurers, this is like not where their mind's at all, right? Like, you don't see much gold on you know, the balance sheet of Fortune 500s, do you? But I, you know, I've heard that it's happening again. I've heard whispers and rumors that, yeah, maybe it's May 15th that we find this out, but I've heard that this is like a real thing again, and corporates are looking to put Bitcoin back on their balance sheet. What do you guys think about that?
I think it's very smart in this specific world. I mean,
Quinn's laughing at me because I sneeze. I always like really make it look hard when I sneeze too. It takes me like 15
seconds. No, I was laughing at Tyler's because I love how just bold, like I love just like, I mean, but
it makes too much sense.
It depends your time horizon. Like, if you're a corp, you don't manage like your working capital to be, you know, you're not just sitting on a shit ton of idle cash. So like, I don't think it really makes sense for most.
This is
probably a better investment than like a lot of people are doing.
I guess if you're a big tech company sitting on piles and piles of cash, would you rather have a treasury yielding what, you know, 4% or maybe 5% of your cash in something that could make 100% return? I don't know.
Well, so you just said the magic word, which is yield, right? This is the big problem that people have with Bitcoin and gold overall. This is why Paul Tudor Jones calls them the barbarous relics. Honestly, everyone hates this opinion when I say it. The ETH people hate it and the Bitcoiners hate it. But the superpower of ETH here is the yield. Like, they should just be leaning into that so hard. Like, yep, Bitcoin's great. Like, if I was counter-positioning, right? Like, I think this whole, I don't know how deep people are in this, but Ethereum tried to do this ultrasound money meme for a bit. They were like, it's even more deflationary with Bitcoin. Like, that was I think that was not a good narrative, because no one really cares if it's like slightly net less inflationary than Bitcoin, but it's confusing and less predictable. It's just, as soon as you get to that, you've lost 90% of the audience. But yield, people love yield. And that's actually the reason why most investors don't buy gold, because they're like, I don't know how to value this. That's an inconquerable wall. Like, most people just never wrap their head around that. But ETH actually does have native yield. And that I could see making a lot more sense.
I do remember that narrative in the last cycle where it was like, hey, you can get 15% yield here.
Yeah.
In ETH. And pensions were like, well, yeah, let's try it a little bit. I think at one point you lock it, you know, you lock it up. But this cycle, yeah, I don't know the rates. I think what makes people nervous was, like, last time it was based off of leveraged, you know, guys like FTX and Three Arrows. And so you had this, it was like fake demand pushing the price up. Like, it was a lot of leverage. I think the leverage was like way different than this cycle. Now you have, you know, Sailor, a little bit of leverage. But last, it was like Three Arrows was like 10 times levered or something. That's where you get in trouble. With Lehman, it was like 20 times leverage. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's different.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's also, you're seeing it, like, it's like we always talk about with where funds are coming in. Like, so much of that retail flow was like people chasing the yields in crypto through these retail lenders, and the makeup of the system is a lot different.
There are super different sources of yield, though. Like, there is a, it's not close to 15%. It's closer to, I think, like 4%. But there is a type of yield that comes from Ethereum that just gets paid out to validators. That is, it's not, there's no such thing as risk-free rate. There's no such thing as a risk-free rate anywhere, even though finance needs that to exist. But if there were, it's completely independent from this, like, demand for borrow, you know, relative value trade that people were putting on last cycle. That's like a whole other different source of yield than what we're like. Ethereum delivers work to validators that are, or a reward to validators that are securing the network. And that's a super different, like, much, much lower reward, but it's also much lower risk source of yields also. But
yeah, people learn the hard way that they were the yield in many cases.
So, maybe one last, I mean, this was just sort of a funny data point that I saw Mike Green tweet out, but he was actually, you know what? I'd rather talk about the Quinn. You did a really good tweet on this sort of, not that I really want to talk politics here, but it feels relevant because I saw Trump today was talk, or this week, he was sort of changing his tune on crypto and Bitcoin. So previously, you know, people, he actually said, you know, you can find these tweets in the past. I only like the US dollar. There shouldn't be more than one currency. I don't like Bitcoin, US dollar, good. And he came out this week and he sort of walked that back a little bit and said something to the effect of, it seems like these cryptocurrency things are fun. I would be supportive of these cryptocurrency things. Seems like his, I don't know. I think like he sounds like he'd be pretty supportive, actually. That was, I mean, yeah, I think it's actually going to be a massive difference for crypto in the US, depending on who wins this election at this point.
Oh, yeah, it's so, I mean, I think crypto has a fantastic year regardless, but it is so critical and could have a huge impact. I mean, that interview was hilarious. Like, the CNBC anchor asked him like a 10-second question on crypto, and he just says the same thing like 8 times for 3 minutes straight and doesn't let the guy get a word in. I mean, it's like, I was just cracking up. Like, yeah, they're fun. They're very fun, you know, and his dollar stuff. But it's like, you could have a situation. I mean, if Warren, Gensler, and all these people who are literally the only thing in the way of, like, more ETFs and more acceptance and banks being able to interact, like that's a huge, huge catalyst. And we're seeing, I saw a stat about, how kind of Western driven, obviously with the ETF, the flows have been, the last few months, like it's despite it being such a emerging market and inflation hedge. And if you're in Argentina or some of these places, you want to own Bitcoin instead of your local currency, a global story, it's very much a developed nation asset as well. And the US leads the way in many cases. So you'd have such a huge unlock. I could see some huge rallies post a Trump victory. And then, like we talked about, it's kind of probably priced in to some extent already. People got, said maybe it reversed a little when Biden was awake for the State of the Union. But I think the tides just in general, point in a really positive direction.
I think it's good for markets overall, but it's extremely good for crypto at this point. I've always thought of Bitcoin a little bit more as a, it's a money, it's a technology, but it's also a little bit of a social movement. I kind of had this theory where, it was interesting. You remember when Rogan, the people who listened to the Spotify employees were essentially, protesting Joe Rogan, and Joe Rogan had to make, people, I was like, oh, Spotify, are you good or bad? They did the thing. They made a business case for this, right? And obviously they came out that the business case was much better to keep Joe Rogan and lose some of their subscribers. Well, if I was Spotify, I'd be thinking, how could I like lean into this, right? Like, okay, I'm going to lose some amount of people who, disagreed with, I think at the time it was like the vaccine stuff that he had a couple guests on that were out of favor with people. It's like, well, if this is my audience anyway, like, how could I lean into this? Like, here's a really low lift thing you could do is you could say, hey, you can now pay in Bitcoin. I mean, what do you think the lift would be, right? If you've already got, like, what do you think the overlap is in between the Rogan audience and people that like Bitcoin? Probably extremely high. And I think any number of companies could have done that. I don't think they really saw it, but I think Trump is like a master of seeing this. And I think he sees there's probably a strong overlap in, like, he could just say a couple things, be roughly supportive of this. It's not going to rock the apple cart too much. And that could be massive for his base. So,
yeah, I'm very with you there. There's a lot of like weird political tides going to sway the next generation, like Biden getting on TikTok, and there's cannabis rescheduling is likely to happen here, apparently, in the political spheres. So they're trying to figure out. Maybe Trump's crypto and Biden's cannabis. We'll see what play, they make there.
They're giving out goodies to the kids. What do the kids want?
I know.
Bitcoin and weed.
You got to have it before your ice cream.
Yeah.
Before he goes to the ice cream store every night.
Yeah. It's like, let's give him some toys, make him happy.
It kind of fits, Trump's the money business guy. He's going to be pushing, I mean, he's a crypto holder himself, the Trump NFTs, he's like, that was so good. When he was talking in that interview about his shoes, and then he talked about the NFTs too. And he just dumped like tens of thousands of these things on the market.
I actually think, RFK might have a chance, and no one's really talking about him.
No.
Pippa Malmgren, who called Trump the first time around, said, she's thinking RFK has a better chance than you think. But, and so I take that with a real,
she's great.
She's incredible. She's my favorite. But like, and you get Aaron Rodgers, like a lot of these narratives.
Is that real?
Crazy.
The Aaron Rodgers thing?
It's rumored, but I think a lot of these narratives that were crazy a couple of years ago are now not so crazy. The world is
what are we doing? This is not
changing fast. This is like
Zelensky was a comedian.
But I guess what I'm trying to say is like there's a lot of like narratives that are breaking down here, and the future could be way wackier than we think. And I don't know, just throwing it out there that
if it looks anything like crypto, I'm all for it. Like, bring it on.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you guys saw the last story of Bernie Sanders advocating for a 4-day work week. I don't know if you saw this.
Good for productivity, right, Mike?
It's just, yeah, it's just on this theme of like all these politicians just giving stuff out. It's like, oh, here, have some weed, have some crypto, have a 4-day work week.
No student loans.
Yeah. No student loans. Oh, yeah. You know,
in New York, it's, you know, you give the preloaded debit cards to the illegal immigrants. They're not immigrants, they're voters.
It's insanity. Yeah, I think need some strong leadership, baby. Need some strong leadership. Fellas, I think we got to end it here. This one was a really fun one. I'll see you guys. Quinn, I'm going to see you in London. Tyler, we're going to send you.
Yeah, I'm going to Utah. I'll go to Salt Lake City, I promise.
All right, sweet.
As long as you don't put me on the last panel.
We'll see. We'll see how you do between now and then on the roundup.
We'll just talk to each other, Tyler. Great. Yeah. No one will be there anyways. See ya.